What's your definition of a hero? Someone who puts themselves in harm's way? Who acts selflessly in the face of adversity? This hour, heroes in our Iowa community. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, conversations with four people being honored by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa as heroes of the heartland. Everyday Iowans who've done something extraordinary. A woman who pulled a boy out of a wrecked car. A man who began the longest kidney transplant chain in Iowa. The coordinator of the Adult Literacy Center at Drake University. And the co-founder of a group called Let's Soar Together. Everyday heroes, after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour, we're talking with some of the most recent recipients of the Heroes of the Heartland Award. It's awarded by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa every year, and these awards go to everyday Iowans who have done something extraordinary. And that certainly describes my next guest, Angie Kopp-Homer, being honored by the Red Cross this year for her intervention in a car crash. Angie Kopp-Homer, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Take us back to the Sunday, March 4th of 2012 that this happened. It was in the early evening, I understand. You were driving in Des Moines. You had your young boy with you, a five-year-old, I believe, freezing rain.
Yes.
And then what did you notice?
When I was driving, I noticed smoke coming from another vehicle that was there.
Okay. Was the vehicle still moving or had it crashed? Or
I was not sure at that time.
Okay. So you're driving on University in Des Moines, I understand. And what did you do when you saw the smoke coming from the vehicle? It was on the side of the road.
Yes. I immediately put my car in park and told my son that I would be right back and went to go see what was happening.
Mm-hmm. And it's worth mentioning here that you are currently in nursing school. You also volunteer as an EMT at the Pleasant Hill Fire Department. So you have some knowledge of how to react to these situations. When you came upon the vehicle, the crashed vehicle, what did you see?
When I came upon the other vehicle, not the one that was smoking, that one was down the road farther. The first one that I came to, I announced that I was a nurse, and the mother was in the driver's seat, and all she kept saying was, "Please get my baby, get my baby."
Mm-hmm. So she was still in the car, or she was outside the car?
She was pinned in the car.
She was pinned in the car, and you saw that there was a child in the car. Where?
I did not see anybody until I had went through the back hatch.
You went through the back hatch. The doors did not work?
The doors were, because of the impact, were crushed shut.
Okay, but the car is still upright at this point, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. You try the door. It's too crushed to get in. You go to the hatch. Did that open?
Yes, it did.
Okay, what did you do?
I pushed down a third row seat and climbed over the second row and found Frederick laying on the floorboard behind the passenger in the driver's seat.
Frederick is the five-year-old victim in this case. Was he conscious?
No, he was not.
So he was laying unconscious in front of that back row seat. What did you do?
I immediately tried pulling him out. I had to have somebody else grab my ankles and actually help pull me out because I couldn't get the weight of him up over the seat without any help.
Mm-hmm. What are you saying at this point? What are the other people around the car saying?
I don't remember what anybody else was saying. All I remember saying was just grab my ankles and pull me out.
And so you were pulled out through the back hatch of this car by your ankles, and you held on to this young boy, and so you were both pulled out?
Yes.
Okay, you pulled him out. You got him next to the vehicle or a safe distance away from the vehicle. What happened then?
I laid him on the ground, checked for pulses, checked for breathing. There were none, so I immediately started CPR.
How long did you perform CPR?
It seemed like it was forever. I would guess it was 5 to 8 minutes.
And he eventually started breathing again?
He did not start breathing again. I restarted his heart by the time that the ambulance service came.
Okay, so you handed this off to the EMTs who arrived in the ambulance, and his heart had resumed?
Yes.
You handed that off, and what did you do after that?
I immediately called my husband and my father.
The boy, Frederick, was in the hospital for 5 days after this crash, and sadly, Frederick died on the fifth day or after the fifth day. Of course, a huge tragedy for the family, first and foremost, but I understand that you visited him every one of those 5 days.
Yes, I did. Multiple times a day sometimes.
What was that like?
Heart-wrenching.
Was he conscious? Did he talk?
No, he never resumed consciousness.
What did you do during your visits there?
I held his hand, stroked his hair, visited with the family, hugged his mom, anything that I could do.
They must have been incredibly grateful that you were there at that scene, even though the outcome was Frederick's death 5 days later.
Yeah.
He died after those days in the hospital. What were your thoughts when you heard he had died?
Shocked. Prognosis kept changing. First, it was going to be he was going to make it but be paralyzed. Then he would be paralyzed and blind. And then it went to that all brain activity ended. And there was nothing that they could do.
I'm thinking this is especially hard for you, too, because you have a son about that age, don't you? Did that make it different, a different experience? Did you think of your own son in a different way?
Yeah. I have four children, so the six-year-old that I had with me, it made it extremely difficult to know that that could have been my baby.
It's been over a year since the crash, since the death of the boy, Frederick. How often did you think about it?
Every single day.
What thoughts come to mind?
Mostly I blame myself. I think that I could have done something different.
Doesn't sound like you could have. What possibly could you have done more than find a way into the vehicle to get the boy out when nobody else was there to do that?
There isn't anything else I could have done.
How do you cope with these thoughts?
I've talked to a lot of healthcare professionals in my field. I go and see a counselor.
Mm-hmm. After this time, is there any sense you can make of it, why you were there at that time?
Absolutely. I was struggling to know where I wanted to be in my career path. And this really made me realize that I wanted to finish my nursing degree.
You're an LPN right now, a licensed practical nurse, and you're training to be an RN?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. I also went to EMT school over the summer after Frederick passed away.
How did this change your view? You had an idea of what you wanted to do. How did it cement the idea of what your calling was?
I realized that I'm here to save people, to help people. This is really what my goal in life is. And the feelings that I get from it are amazing.
There's a bit of a silver lining in this story. I understand that Frederick's mother, Danielle, allowed his organs to be donated.
Yes.
Could we draw a conclusion that that your saving Frederick, at least for those 5 days, helped those who received the organ donations?
Yes. When I restarted his heart, that got blood flowing to every organ in his body again, which kept them viable and living for those 5 days.
About that aspect, you must feel great about that.
I do. I believe organ donation is a very powerful thing. knowing that I couldn't save him, even though I tried, that 8 or 9 children could be living right now because of that and because of what I did.
I wonder, you mentioned, Angie, that you are the mother of, did you say 4 children?
Yes.
How have you talked about this with your own children?
Frederick lives on our refrigerator. They know everything about him. They wrote him notes to send up to heaven when we released balloons at the crash site.
You released balloons? Tell me about that.
Yeah. His funeral was down in Texas where his mom is from. I was unable to attend that. So the people in Oskaloosa, where they live now, released green balloons, which were his favorite color. And I did that the same here with my children and tied notes to the strings of the balloon. And they released them to heaven.
Frederick is on your refrigerator for your family as a reminder. Do you notice that it's changed your family, how you interact with your children?
Yes. I think that they think of Frederick as a little brother, and they see him every day and know that he is watching over us.
You are a recipient of the Heroes of the Heartland Award, a recognition given by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa for what is undoubtedly a heroic achievement. How do you feel about this award?
I got called a hero ever since that day, and I don't think that I am. I think that I did what anybody else would have done, and I would assume should have done.
Angie Cupp Homer, thank you very much for sharing a very difficult story. I'm sorry. It's still causing you pain, obviously, but thank you very much for sharing it with us today, and congratulations on your award.
Thank you for having me.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Tyler Weig. He is a recipient of a Heroes of the Heartland Award. It's awarded by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa to everyday Iowans who have done something extraordinary. That's what we're focusing on this hour. Several stories of these extraordinary Iowans. So Weig is receiving his award for starting a kidney donation chain, and we'll tell you about that in just a minute. Tyler Weig, welcome to our program.
Appreciate it.
You live in Des Moines. I understand you work as a consultant for something called the Urban Core Initiative to help youth in urban neighborhoods.
That is correct.
Let's talk a little bit about the kidney donation chain. I don't even know what that is. This is the first time I've heard it. What is it?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't know anything about it either until I participated in it.
Okay.
A kidney donation chain is an opportunity for incompatible donors to be able to help their recipient. For example, there might be a husband who needs a kidney and his wife would like to donate to him, but they aren't compatible. And the donation chain allows people to essentially swap partners to ensure that the people who need kidneys get them and the people who can give can give. So working with Mercy Medical Center here in Des Moines, we were able to put together a kidney donation chain that involved 10 people, 5 donors and 5 recipients, and the exchange of 5 kidneys over the course of 3 days, all in the same facility. And it was one of the most miraculous things I've ever been a part of.
How unique is this in the country?
This isn't the largest one in America, but it is the largest one in Iowa. It's hopefully going to be more well-known, but it is fairly unique. It's been around for quite a number of years, but it's starting to gain traction now.
How do you do this? Is there a database where the blood type and the kidney compatibility is kept so that you can find these people? I would think it would be terribly difficult.
Well, to be honest, there are a lot of people out there who would love to give their kidney to the person that they care about, but they aren't a match. So this is an opportunity to take all those people, all those donors and recipients who may be incompatible, and combine them in a way, like a kidney donation chain, so all the donors can be connected with the recipients. It's done. Mine was done at Mercy Medical Center. They take all your charts and records, everything from your body type to your kidney's specific qualities and your blood type, and they kind of connect the dots.
Mm-hmm. Tyler Weig, tell us a little bit more about your personal story, one of the reasons you're being honored here. How did this start for you, and who was the specific person you gave a kidney to?
It started for me when I saw the opportunity on the internet, and when I read about this man who needed a kidney. I thought it was kind of an interesting way to look for a kidney. And the more I looked into it, the more I thought, you know, maybe I'm that person. Maybe I'm that person sitting at home looking on the internet for whatever, and this man's image pops up on my screen. Maybe I'm the man who's compatible.
You're the match.
So that revelation got me interested in getting tested. It got me interested in learning more about living kidney donation. And the more I learned about it, and I tell this to people, knowledge is power. When I initially told folks, you know, this is something I'm interested in doing, I got some surprised looks, as you can imagine.
Some surprising remarks, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Well, what did you hear?
Well, you don't hear every day that someone wants to donate an organ. But for me, the more I learned about it, the more I learned about the few risks and the many, many rewards, the more I learned about how big of an issue it is. More than 90,000 people in America wait for a kidney. More than 500 people here in Iowa wait for a kidney. And I realized, you know, I want to do this. I have two kidneys. I am very fortunate to be healthy. I only need one to live. And I started to go through the process of getting tested, which was a very thorough testing, physical, emotional, psychological testing. And during that process, I became even more empowered to do it. When you start to learn about how people's lives are impacted by kidney disease, what they have to go through on a daily basis, it empowered me to say, you know what? I want to make a change here. Mm-hmm. And this was the opportunity to do that.
Did you learn about the recipient of your kidney?
I did not know my recipient until 2 days after the surgery. And that was a very powerful moment to both be wheeled into the same room and to look at this man and know that something that once was inside of me is now inside of him, functioning and hopefully helping him, was a moment that I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm. Can you name him?
His name is Lance, and truthfully, I can't tell you more than that. You know, we've met each other just a few times, and I've gotten that question before of what was he going through, and I don't know. Right. But I do know that there are hundreds of people here in Iowa going through things that I know I hope I never have to go through.
So you were wheeled into the OR, put under, with the knowledge that one of your kidneys would be removed, and you knew that there was someone else in that immediate vicinity that would receive that kidney, and then you met that person soon after that. What was the atmosphere? What were the words exchanged?
Tears, you know, and as I think about it here talking to you, I crack up a little bit thinking about it because it's a moment that you can't prepare for. I knew that somebody was going to receive my kidney. And I had no idea, young, old, man, woman, I had no idea who it was going to be. And when they wheeled him in and we looked at each other, he said to me, he said, "Are you the guy?" And I said, "Yep, I'm the guy." And it was just, I was at a loss for words, and I think he was too. And I think we now have some sort of connection that I'll never be able to share with anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Will you keep in contact with Lance?
Perhaps. It happened 3 months ago, so we're kind of still in the process of taking it all in and figuring out what that's going to look like.
Have there been any negative consequences, any downside of this for you health-wise, in terms of what you can and cannot eat or drink, or for instance?
No. I there's a period of about 6 weeks that you're restricted on your lifting and, you know, physical activity, but I'm back doing the things I was doing before, and I've had no ill effects from it.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about being selected as a recipient of this Heroes of the Heartland Award by the Red Cross?
Honored. A friend of mine, childhood friend, who I admire very much, nominated me for the award, and I couldn't help but feel great about it. I feel like I don't really like the attention, but I cherish the moment that people are recognizing that this was a great thing that happened. Truthfully, I think the important thing for me is there are so many heroes out there. Every organ donor is a hero, and they aren't going to necessarily receive this award, but I see them as heroes. And I also see heroes in the medical field, the surgeons and the social workers and the nurses and everyone else who participated in the donation chain. There were five people who donated their kidney to someone they didn't know, and they deserve the award just as much as I do. So I'm honored that to be nominated and to be selected. But I also am mindful of the fact that it took a lot of people to make this happen, and it couldn't have happened without their support and help.
Tyler Weig, I understand you used to work for the American Cancer Society.
I did.
Uh-huh. How did that experience influence, motivate you in this case, or did it?
I'd say there's been a lot of experiences in my life that have led me to this point. And one of the things about working at the American Cancer Society is it's a very life-affirming position. I was able to see people who fought for their lives, and some survived cancer and some didn't. And just the kind of vigor that they showed to say, you know what, I'm going to live my life every day in the best way I can, no matter what, was very empowering for me. And one of the things that I really took out of it was I had a friend of mine pass away from cancer, and we all hoped and wondered if there would be a solution to her problem. By a solution, I mean a cure or some sort of treatment that would prolong her life or save her life. And there wasn't. And I know people out there are always looking for that, hoping for a drug company to come up with something, and they do, hoping for some other treatment option. But now I like to play offensively. I don't like to wait and see what might happen or could happen. Right now, the opportunity exists that there is a treatment option out there called organ transplantation that works. And for me, that's a very empowering feeling to say, you know what, I'm not going to wait for something else to happen. We have this here now, and I'm going to use this, and I hope other people do, to save a life.
How can people find out more about this process, perhaps consider being put on a list to donate a kidney or another organ?
I'd encourage everyone to at least learn more. You don't have to do it, but the more you learn, you might find it deep in your heart that this is something you can do to make a difference. Folks can look at the Iowa Donor Network, which provides a lot of information. You can talk to your local medical facility. You can talk to the United Network of Organ Sharing. There's a variety of resources out there, but the most important thing is knowledge is power. I didn't make this decision willy-nilly. I had a lot of professionals who helped me make an educated decision about me and my health. And I would recommend other people seek out that same information.
Tyler Weig, recipient of a Heroes of the Heartland Award, awarded by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa, to Iowans, everyday Iowans, who have done something extraordinary. Tyler, thank you for your extraordinary act and the message you've delivered today. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Coming up after a short break, more Everyday Heroes. Ann Murr, the coordinator of the Adult Literacy Center at Drake University, and Ann Thomas, the co-founder of a group that helps special needs children called Let's Soar Together. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we are exploring Heroes of the Heartland. These are recipients we're talking to today of a Heroes of the Heartland Award, and awarded by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa to everyday Iowans who have done something extraordinary. And my next guest is Ann Murr. She is the coordinator of the Adult Literacy Center at Drake University and a recipient of a Heroes of the Heartland Award. Ann Murr, welcome to our program, and congratulations.
Why, thank you.
Tell us about the Adult Literacy Center and the people that you serve at Drake.
Well, first of all, I want to tell you that the heroes are the adults that we serve and the volunteers that give their time every week to meet one-to-one, to do lesson planning, to plan activities, to help our adults learn. So they're the heroes. And the students range in age from 18 to 80. We have one student who's past 80, and she's still actively reading. They come because they want to be more functional, more independent in their lives. They can read to a point, but when you read, you're an adult and you read at third grade, fifth grade level, you aren't able to achieve your goals, to be productive, to give to your family, to feel confident in yourself. Mm-hmm. And so they reach the point where they say, you know, I can make my life a whole lot better if I could read better.
How long has your Adult Literacy Center been around, Ann?
Since 1976.
1976?
Yes.
That's
yes.
a nice long chunk
yes.
of time. Now, in that center, would you wager a guess as to how many people you've served and helped along in their literacy?
Over 100 adults a year in the past 4 years. Our numbers are going up slowly because we can't grow too much because we're dependent on volunteers.
So we can safely say thousands of adults have been...
Since 1976, of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, and you've had personal contact with, I have to
all
believe,
of them.
All of these
yes.
people. Help us understand some of the reasons adults fail to learn how to read, because thankfully for many of us, it's something that we acquire in grade school. And then
right.
we take for granted,
right.
don't we?
Yes, we do take it for granted. Now, just verbal skills, excuse me, verbal skills are one of the multiple intelligences, as are musical, athletic, you know, the math, the logical, the interpersonal. Okay, so half of us in the population will have no trouble learning to read. The other half is going to have some measure of difficulty. And the bottom 20 to 40% are really going to struggle. It is a brain wiring thing. It's also, you know, if you have a home where there are no books, parents don't read, that has an effect. But it's truly a way that the brain isn't wired for words. And so these folks, these children in school need very specific, direct, one-to-one or small group intensive instruction. And they get it to a point, but many kind of fall through the cracks.
Mm-hmm. Take me through the process. When someone identifies themselves or somehow is encouraged to get some help with literacy, what do you do when someone walks through the door looking for help? You assess that, right?
Yes. First of all, I try to make them feel as welcome and as comfortable as possible, because I've heard over the years, I just heard from two people today who told me how hard it was for them to walk through the door at the first time.
Why would that be?
Because they have hid it for so long. They've been ridiculed. They've been made fun of. People treat them as less than or not capable in any way because of reading problems. They truly have had so many demeaning experiences in school and in life as an adult. So they're very capable of hiding it and compensating and presenting themselves as capable.
Okay, and then the learning part. Once you figure out where they are and where you'd like to take them, how does the learning take place? And and is that different for an adult than someone who is learning to read in grade school?
You know, that's the first question I asked when I started in adult literacy 14 years ago, because my background is early childhood. I know how young children acquire language as a natural process, first by babbling and playing around with, you know, copying and pretending, then when they're starting to write and pretending to write, and then, you know, that's a natural process, and then they're reading. And so I wondered, do adults learn the cognitive process for learning to read? Is it the same? And the answer is a definitive yes. It's so what the babies and young children are doing is connecting how sounds match with letters, how sounds are put together to speak, to say words, and then to string those words into sentences. Mm-hmm. And that transaction between sound and letter is something that the brain isn't wired naturally to do for folks who are struggling to learn to read.
Are there certain people who you've experienced, try as they may, simply cannot learn to read any better?
When you think of you know, in 100 people, there's the most gifted at 100 and the one at the very bottom that has you know, deep deficits. Those at that very low level, I won't say they Well, they can never reach functional literacy. They can learn to read to maybe do some, you know, the basic reading, but not to, you know, beyond a beginning reading level.
And we've learned that shame is a big part of the suffering that people go through when they can't read as well as they'd like to or can't read it at all. Do you have a special case that comes to mind that illustrates how strong that shame can be?
Well, the woman that first introduced me to adult literacy, she was the first person I tutored, actually the second person I tutored when I first was a volunteer with the adult literacy program at Drake. And she told me, and this was years ago, but she told me that when she was in third grade, it was obvious she wasn't able to read, so they put her in special ed where she did crafts and puzzles and things. And when she was in eighth grade, they told her that she was too stupid to go to high school, that she should just drop out. And that really put her life on a path for some years that was very difficult. But she started a business and raised three fine sons. So she's made a way for herself, but had to work through some pretty demeaning issues.
That's right. And what is the connection, if any, between illiteracy, having problems in this area, and intelligence? Is there any?
No. The areas of the brain that process the basic components of words and then send that into the memory is a different part of the brain that then where intelligence is. Intelligence is in the frontal lobe, and if you see the brain scans of struggling readers and compare it to good readers, the struggling readers, the area in their brain that's more active is the frontal lobe, because they're using all their guessing and reading around and trying to figure out from what they can in the words. So they're working really hard. They're using their intelligence to read. Because the part of the brain that's wired to make the connections between sounds and letters and putting that all together into words, which is a very complex process that we take for granted,
that
part of the brain is not as active.
Is it a problem, Anne, to find material to practice? Let's say someone's reading at a second or third grade level. If they're 40 or 50 years old, they most likely would not be interested in reading the content that is in a level of reading at that.
That is a challenge, and we have fortunately just identified some online materials developed by an adult basic education program in a neighboring state that's free and online and written for adults at grade levels below first grade, clear through eighth grade. So that's been very helpful, and the technology there, the computer will read it aloud to them so they can listen to it and then read along and then read independently. And then we are finding some other materials that are written at the second, third, fourth grade level that we're finding user-friendly.
You said, Anne, that you come at this from a teaching background. Did you ever personally have problems learning to read?
Not a bit. No, I don't remember how I learned to read.
So where did the empathy come from, the drive to help these people?
Well, when you see people who feel so disempowered and they haven't known how to speak out for themselves. So, you know, the Declaration of Independence says everyone has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And being able to read contributes in all of those areas. Frederick Douglass said, when I learn to read, I will be forever free. So those who don't read don't feel free, and they don't have hope. And so if I can do whatever I can to give them that hope and to help them become more free, more independent, more excited about learning and confident in themselves, well, that's the opportunity I've been given.
And finally, Anne, let's suppose someone is listening who cannot read or cannot read very well, an adult. Speak to that person. What advice, what encouragement do you have for that person listening?
You can learn. There may be experiences in your life that's told you that you can't, but you can. And I know that it's difficult to ask for help, but just know there's help. in adult literacy programs, you come to the Drake Adult Literacy Center if you're close to Des Moines, or you go to a community college and ask for the adult basic education program there, because there are people who want to help, and they're there to help you. And taking the first step is the hardest one of all, but when you do it, it means that you're on a path to learning and to growing, and it can be exciting, it can be fun.
Ann Murr, thank you for joining us. Here's to you and all of the rest of the heroes that you've helped, as you identified at the very start, coordinator of the Adult Literacy Center at Drake University. Ann, I love your passion. And how many lives you've changed. I can't tally them. You can't either.
Well, it's volunteers, too. Volunteers get right. The opportunity to do something very productive, and it's beneficial in their lives as well.
Congratulations as a recipient of Heroes of the Heartland Award, and thank you for joining us. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and finally, our last recipient of a Heroes of the Heartland Award, an award from the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa. These are awards to everyday Iowans who have done something extraordinary. And our last guest today is Ann Thomas, co-founder of an organization called Let's Soar Together. And its focus is to provide contact and support to families of special needs kids. And she joins me in our Des Moines studio. Ann Thomas, welcome to our program and congratulations for this award.
Thank you very much.
Now, I understand this began and has something to do with your daughter, right?
Yes. My involvement in the group, I've been involved with the group since the beginning. I was one of the founding members. And my journey there wouldn't have happened without my daughter. I have a daughter who's 10 and a half who was born with a chromosome disorder called 1p36, which basically means that she's missing some genetic material off of the end of her first chromosome. The results are very similar to, say, a child with Down syndrome. She's globally delayed. She's got some distinguishing facial features. So we got her diagnosis at about a year. And at the time, I was just kind of in need of, I don't know, other people that maybe had, you know, were in a similar situation that could tell me it was going to be okay.
Yeah, sure. That initial diagnosis is probably the most challenging time, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
What did you go through at that point?
You know, you go through a lot of emotions, obviously. I think it's very much similar to the grieving process where, you know, first it's disbelief. We were, for a very long time, we called our pediatrician Dr. Doom because we didn't think there was anything wrong with our daughter, and we were kind of mad that she insisted there was. You know, then you go through the grieving process when you realize that maybe you're not going to have the child you had hoped you were going to have, that perfect child. And so it just helps to have, just with any grieving process, helps to have other people that you can kind of turn to.
And this is where these social events aspect of Let's Soar Together comes together, because two or three times a year, I understand, families from the West Des Moines, Waukee area get together. What sort of valuable things do you see going on at such events?
Well, really, it's just about connections, particularly for the families with the younger kids. You know, in our situation with Kate being almost 11 now, you know, things are kind of running smoothly for us. We're in a, you know, in a groove, and we really know what to expect for her. But you know, those families with the little kids where they're just getting their diagnosis, or they're really just learning what the diagnosis means for them for the long haul, it just helps to know that it's not the end of the world when your child has that, you know, that label put on them, that disability label put on them.
Have you recognized that when they come to that group for the first time, that they're out, they walk in out of that sense of isolation into your group?
Yes. It's not super obvious. I mean, you don't see their faces light up or anything like that, but it's really neat to look around and just see the family sitting at tables just talking to each other. And it may just be, you know, just, hey, you know, what kind of baseball do you think I could find for my son? Or, hey, do you have a dentist that maybe would, you know, be able to get into my kid's mouth because he won't open? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just those kinds of things, just the everyday stuff. It's not, I don't know,
what's the word? It's not like, you know, bells are going off and right. the sky's opening up. It's just that, you know, the little connections.
Talk about another activity of Let's Soar Together, the donation of these iPads and iPods. Some may not understand how they can be used so well for kids, special needs kids. What's going on there?
My daughter, Kate, she's probably her biggest impact with her syndrome is the fact that she can't really talk. She can certainly make vocalizations, but she just has trouble making her brain make her mouth make the sounds, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an application that she has on her personal iPad that allows her to basically push an icon and it makes that word. So she's able to build small sentences, long sentences, and communicate with her teachers, her friends at school. So that's one example of a very beneficial application that's on the iPad. We've got quite a few autistic children within the school district and even, you know, within the members that we serve. And they use these little devices just as motivational devices, just, you know, hey, just to reward them for good behavior or to motivate them maybe to focus just a little bit longer on their task at hand because they know they're going to get to play a little bit later on the iPad. These kids, a lot of them are just – it's amazing how smart they are with technology. My daughter, who can't – she can write her first name, can't write her last name, definitely can't. You know, she can pretty much write every letter of the alphabet, but that's about it. She can run that iPad like you would not believe.
Oh, really?
So this technology lets those kids that maybe have a limited, you know, fine motor skill or something really kind of excel at, in things that maybe they wouldn't be able to otherwise.
And you just talked about how your daughter uses the iPad, but there are other disabilities, other children with needs. I'm thinking of a child you have in the classroom that has a sight impairment.
Yes. One of our board members, her son, was born prematurely and as a result has some vision impairment. He lost his sight completely in one eye and is legally blind in the other. And so he's able to use this technology to they basically use it to enlarge things so that he can see, you know, text or what have you.
Let me end with this. And I guess we can agree that over the decades, we've come a long way in our society in terms of helping children with special needs, integrating them and hopefully lessening the stigma for them and their families. Where do you see room for improvement?
Yeah, I completely agree. When we first got Katie's diagnosis, that was one of my very first thoughts was, oh, what does this mean for my son, who is typical and older? And what does this mean for my daughter? You know, is she going to get made fun of at school? Is she going to get picked on? And I have to say that we have been pleasantly surprised. And actually, our experience has been just the opposite, where the kids at school have almost fight each other to be the one to help Kate at lunch or play with her on the playground. One little girl basically, you know, brings her into the building every day, makes sure she gets her stuff into her locker and gets into the classroom and you know, just makes sure she's okay all throughout the day.
That must be a great feeling.
It really is. And I think where maybe more progress could be made is just more accommodations. And, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, the school district budgets are so limited and, you know, their class sizes are so huge just because they don't have money. So, you know, completely understand that the money isn't there, but just you know, one of the focuses that our group has is just kind of trying to get some adaptive equipment out onto the playgrounds for some of the kids that maybe have limited mobility. Before I had a friend who has a child with a limited mobility, it didn't even dawn on me that bark on playground floors doesn't work for wheelchairs. It hadn't even occurred to me until I was part of this group. So, you know, things like that still need to happen. I would love to see cities, you know, city parks, you know, don't put down bark, put down the rubber tiles and maybe have one or two swings that are, you know, fully back swings so children with trunk control issues can swing. You know, so I think we're getting there. And that's kind of one of our focuses is just having those conversations with the civic organizations locally. Right now we're having conversations with the Waukee Parks and Rec to hopefully, as they redo their parks, maybe add some adaptive equipment. So there's definitely room for improvement, but yeah, I think it's wonderful the way kids are included today where they weren't when I was a kid.
Well, Ann Thomas of Waukee, co-founder of Let's Soar Together, congratulations once again as a recipient of a Heroes of the Heartland Award from the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa. We appreciate your work, your conversation today, and give our best to Katie.
I will. Thank you very much.
And that does it for this hour of River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pimble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. Get in touch with us anytime. Our email is rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.